with my experience. And I quickly realized that the brick weight kind of arrangement thing was totally flawed for an antenna, because the counterweight theory with the pulley involves the counterweight can be traveling down as the tree rapidly whips the other direction, and rather than halving or reducing your load on your antenna, it can multiply it by many times. I'm convinced that rather than a weight, something of a bungee cord system is a much more practical way to do it. Not a bungee cord system with hooks, just raw bungee cord tied in loop, multiple loops, because it can react much quicker and has no momentum built into it that can amplify the load versus reducing the load. So I throw that out there for your consideration.
I agree. Momentum is kind of the killer. I don't think it was much of a killer for mine because, again, not really a tree I'm dealing with. It was a metal pole, and it was just the wind pushing my fan dipole to and fro. But a spring would probably work just as well, right?
A spring probably has a benefit over a weight, but a spring generally has some weight to it anyway, so it has more momentum to it, has more... Yeah, momentum is really the correct term. Whereas a bungee cord system is lightweight, quick to respond, and doesn't have any momentum.
Well, it isn't massless, so it has negligible momentum probably. And also it depends upon how heavy duty a spring would be required. It depends upon the forces that are acting on the rope and such.
All true. Keep in mind that a weight has to rely on the theory, which it is, the theory of gravity, and the laws, which aren't laws, that it obeys to accelerate at a certain rate. Bungee cord has no such parameters, and it will keep a certain tension. And I think mechanically it's a more sound system to work with in trees in specific. That's my... semi-professional opinion. Electrically on antennas, I defer to you guys completely.
Okay, you make a good point. I just want to reference, unfortunately, science has a different meaning when we say theory than the average guy. You know, if someone has an idea that people get crazy during full moons, that's their own personal theory. In science, theory tends to be much more rigorous. It's a repeatedly non-disproven theory of how things work. Germ theory is still a theory, but I think we all believe in germs. Gravitational theory is a theory. Quantum mechanics is theories. Relativity is theories. There's nothing better in science than a theory. So unfortunately, although the layperson kind of uses it kind of wishy-washy, as I have a clever idea that maybe is right but probably is wrong. So you're not going to find anything harder than a scientific theory in science. There are no absolutes, and everything is up for questions, which is the way it should be. And, you know, sometimes some people get this weird idea that science is just another religion where you have to have faith in things. You should be able to deal with science without any faith. A lot of it is based on experimental methods that you often can reproduce yourself and is reproduced in college laboratories all the time.
I didn't mean to segue so far with my tongue-in-cheek comment. Merely that theories of gravity in relation to bricks and antennas are... really thorough observations of what is actually happening, not actually describing why. Anyway, mechanically, in my experience, something like a bungee cord system in a dynamic system like that is superior, and I'll be heading in that direction with my rigging. Didn't mean to send it too far off into the ether.
No problem, Jim. I just it's one of those things I hear a little bit too often, and you do. That I like to kind of put it back in the center. And I thank you for giving me the opportunity to chat on the subject. So I thank you, Jim, and I thank you, Chet, and I thank everyone who got involved in this. Let's see if we can come up with any other topics for discussion tonight. The night is still young. So if anyone out there has either a question or a comment or a topic for discussion, please feel free to hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign. Yes, Frank. Hello. How are you tonight?
Yeah, first of all, I didn't get the fallen name of this fellow who was, got his Wyndham or a G5 open wire fed antenna. I forget whether it's a Wyndham or a G5RV design. I think they're different, working far down as 80 meters. That's 69 feet per leg. First a question and then a comment. First of all, was that 69 feet per leg or 69 total, a little longer than a half-wave coax that dipole would be on 40 meters? Go ahead.
Yes, right. It was 69 total. It was 46 on the long side and 23 on the short side, so it was a two-thirds, one-third off-center dipole, and he added to that beyond the he fed it through a open line, 300 ohm open line, to a ballon. I think it was 30 feet down to a 6-to-1 ballon, and then at the output of the ballon, he connected a 70-odd foot counterpoise.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's really good. It sounds short for 80 meters. I've actually worked CX on an antenna that I, open wire fed antenna that was probably no longer than that I used that to get on 80 meters from my old station in Brooklyn. And between that and using 100 watts to an off-center fed, dipole. I don't honestly know the exact length at one of remote ham radio's remote sites. I've worked 100 countries on 80 meters. I haven't submitted it to the league to certify that yet. But I actually have 100 countries confirmed on 80 meters. So you can work with it. You'd be surprised. You kind of know the propagation on the band. Between sunrise and sunset, probably even at this point in the sunspot cycle, you can work some amazing stuff on 75 and 80 meters. It's a matter of knowing in what sections of the band to operate and when to operate. And if you guys would like me to elaborate a little more, I can. If you want to move on, that's fine also. Go ahead, Roy.
No, Frank, we have time. It's just that the way that you phrased it from sunrise to sunset, did you kind of mean sunset to sunrise? Because, 80 and 160 tends to be always better during the nighttime than during the day. You know, it kind of lights up the D layer and tends to produce a lot of static and increased noise.
I guess you're 100% right. I had that backwards, sunset to sunrise. You can hear, some DX before sunset and after sunrise on 80, but it's very difficult to work because their noise level is higher, I've been told. I had this discussion with Dick years ago. Notice this on 40 meters also. But yes, you're correct. I had it backwards. Sunset to the sunrise. You can work some amazing stuff on 80 and even 160 if you have an antenna capable of doing that. If you want me to go on, as I said, if you want me to go on, I will. If you want to go on to another topic, it's fine also.
We have a lot of free time, Frank. The only problem that I tend to have, and it was mentioned, I think Chet mentioned it earlier, is that 75 seems to be a wee bit more cliquish and buddies Whereas, you know, you go to 40 and certainly 20, and there's a lot of people that just are throwing out CQs, what have you. Whereas you go down to 80 and 160, and there are these coffee clutches going on of guys who've been chatting with each other back and forth for the last 20 or 30 years. And, you know, if you haven't been talking to them for at least 10 years, they consider you a stranger.
Yeah, well, it depends on the kind of ham radio you want to do. I go down below all those guys. The so-called VX window, is, I guess it's still considered 3775 to 3800. So I believe the phone band now goes much lower. You can go much further down the band on sideband now. So you go below frequency-wise, below all those nets, below all the range viewers, you can work some amazing things. Even though you do find some of the cliquish behavior, as you say, the guys with very big signals on 3795, will sit there and kind of create a round table, and you have to wait for them to get around and let you get on there to call the DX stations you're working. So, yeah, you see that on 75 meters. And you don't see that elsewhere. And on CW, gets below all the nets and all the other garbage. Below 3530, preferably below 3525 if your license permits. What's now there's FT8. Sometimes it seems like, as we've discussed before, sometimes FT8 doesn't seem to obey the normal rules of propagation. It probably does follow a more closely on 80 meters and 160 than other bands. Anyway, that's a whole other game. But, you know, if you're interested in really seeing what you can do on that band, you kind of have to pick your frequency and pick your times of day. Go ahead.
Yeah, I understand. I've played around all over the place with FT8, and I am never not amazed by the incredible popularity. You know, 10 meters was kind of dead as a proverbial doornail. But despite it, if you went to the FT8 frequencies, there were still people who were getting through the noise and the other nonsense. So it always seems to prevail. And it was kind of popular as soon as it was released, and I don't think anyone has tired of it, because whenever I pass by, I see loads and loads and loads of people trying to tag other guys on it.
Yeah, I think tagging people on it is probably a good description of FT8. It's what I think some sociologists would call counting coup. You know, just kind of touch and, or aviators might call it touch and go. In some ways, not what we traditionally call a contact. But for the time being, anyway, the ARRL still counts it for their award. How did you do on 10 meters today, by the way? I worked some DX on 10 meters today, but you know, that was using a station with a off-center-fed dipole hanging 100 feet over Long Island Sound, I think. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was surprisingly disappointing. When I came on and I was tuning up, there were at least a few German stations on, because there was apparently a German contest going on. And when I went to the 28.380 at the usual frequency for the Kings County Radio Club's 10-meter net, no one DX from DX land came by to say hello. There were conversations. I saw it on my pan adapter, at least three of them on 10 meters, but they were busy contesting. So I only had to speak to a couple of local people. We didn't get away from, I'm trying to think if I even talked to Queens. I think it was just basically Brooklyn.
Yeah, okay, well, I can believe you. the thing on 10 meters, of course, is that is, in fact, the inverse of what 80 meters does. It can just disappear right at sunset unless you have a good antenna in a really good location or you're on FT8. So it wouldn't surprise me by the time you got the net on. And, of course, the German stations were only working the contest. I think they call it worked all Germany contest. I think some people calling it jokingly the World Against Germany contest. And I tell them, I think the Germans tried that twice in the last century. They lost both times. Go ahead.
Yeah, but we're all friends now.
Well, thank God. Yeah, and especially on amateur radio. That's one of the great things about amateur radio, is you say, well, you know, everybody's friends, but that's one of the things that makes it interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's sort of interesting also how different people respond differently to international problems. You know, when the Russians started to act up, there were people who said they should be shunned, and other people that said, no, we're a brotherhood, we're a fellowship, it doesn't matter, they're a fellow ham, talk to them, type of thing. And I think that's kind of where it's settled at this point. I really haven't heard any anti-Russian amateur radio operator slogan in the last year. So, you know, I mean, I don't think either being nice or not nice to Russian amateur radio operators is going to have much of an effect on Putin's government anyway, one way or the other.
They do take their radio contesting very seriously. I'm not sure what the ARRL is doing, whether the ARRL is still not giving Russian stations competitive awards in its contest. Apparently, I haven't looked it up, but TQ may not be, because the Siberian Radio Club is counter-programming the TQ Worldwide contest by running its Worldwide CW contest on the same weekend as a CQ phone contest, and running its worldwide phone contest on the same weekend as a CW contest. So there is some counter-programming going on there. The Russian stations are still on the ARRL system, LOTW. One of the things I know when I work a Russian station, I'm going to get an LOTW confirm within a week. They're still uploading their logs to that system. There was a Russian de-expedition team running around Africa for a couple of months. I don't think they're there anymore. they take their ham radio very seriously. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, they're great competitors. They took their chess seriously. They take games, soccer, they take seriously. I don't know of anything they don't take particularly seriously. I tend to think the ARRL has been working the diplomatic side. You know, we're all brothers type of thing. Whereas CQ Magazine is, you know, a couple of guys just sort of publishing a magazine on a good month. So, you know, they could be as political and biased as they would like to. I mean, I like CQ. I don't love it. It's not quite as technical as I would prefer it to be, but I understand. But, I mean, they're going through really hard times. I mean, magazines in general are going out of business, and the magazines that are connected to organizations are a little safer, so I don't expect QSD to go anywhere soon. But CQ Magazine, I sort of subscribe to it. I say sort of because it's not like I get a magazine every month. I get a magazine every couple of months. I have the same problem. There's also another magazine that maybe a few people have heard about called Nuts and Bolts, which is basically a kind of a guerrilla popular electronics with some ham radio thrown in. And, you know, I just got there some edition that was dated 2022 because they decided that even though they can't make the publication dates, they're not going to skip any of the issues. So they'll never be in sync again, I guess. So I feel really bad about these magazines. Guys out there, if you like a magazine and you borrow your friend, consider buying your own so that they don't go out of business.
Well, QST, in a sense, is, I don't want to start any rumors here, it's sort of the print magazine is sort of going away. It is and it isn't. Let me get that straight. The print magazine is not going away, let me say it properly. But as I understand it, what they're doing is the print hard copy magazine is no longer part of your membership. You have to subscribe separately, if I understand correctly what they're doing, as of January 2024. And unless you want to pay extra, you're going to have to get it online, which I prefer anyway. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a $30 additional pay. We discussed it a few months ago, and I think that's kind of excessive. Again, I sort of understand they don't want to lose any money, and apparently they've been in the red occasionally. And getting paper apparently is a problem. I remember about 6 to 9 months ago, they published an edition where they used really terrible thin paper. You could, the ink on the other side bled through, and I emailed them and said, what the hell's going on? And they said, you know, we're terribly sorry. This was the only paper we could get at the time. We're going to try never to do that again. So they're having publication issues. And, you know, I mean, I read, I scan the original, the online version, when it's out, because it's out much sooner than I get the mail publication, but I like to read paper. You know, I got myself a Kindle because I prefer the Kindle's display technology a little bit more than LCDs. Bright lights shining in my eyes, reading long articles can kind of get them tired. But I don't think it's going any place too soon because it's not like they're discontinuing the magazine. I think they'll always have it online. Depending upon how many people pay the $30 charge, if not enough, and it's not cost effective, I could see a time where they say, okay, we're just going to go completely to online. You know, if you want to print it out yourself and read it, so be it. But otherwise, tough luck. Which, thankfully, I'm a member also of the Radio Society of Great Britain. I get their magazine called Radcom, and they at least haven't gone to those levels. It costs a bunch of money to subscribe. It costs about $80, which is probably kind of equivalent. But they're not pulling any online for free, and we'll send you the printed copy for $30 or so. So that's good.
Yeah, well, I took the ARRL. When I renewed my membership, I thought the cost is really crazy now, but then the cost of everything is really crazy now, so maybe that's just my perception. And then even if you're a member, they charge you a ridiculous amount for every award you apply for. At one time, they were saying once you're age 70, you can take a life membership but not pay for your awards anymore. But they may have changed that because I haven't seen that lately, and I'm not too worried yet. I still have another 4 years to go before I'm that age. Go ahead.
You're a life member?
No, unfortunately, I'm not. I really should have done that when I was a child. Price was like $200 then, and it was like, forget it, mommy and daddy are never going to pay this. But I should have convinced them to do it because I would have, I would have paid them far less over the years. Go ahead.
Yeah, once again, it's 20/20 hindsight. I wish I had it. I wish everyone had it. It would make life much easier. But, yeah, it's a big bullet right now, and I don't think they're even accepting life memberships for a while. They're trying to figure out how to adjust the price according to the prices that they're, that they've changed for regular annual dues. I don't know. Sometimes the ARRL really annoys me. They always offer you books and such. You put in the discount code when you renew your membership, and they send you books. And I think I've tried that. Many years I got loads of books. I got repeater manuals. I got sundry, antenna, not the handbook, but, the short ones. But the last few years, I put in the discount code to get the books and never got it, and never even bothered to complain. I guess that's another way that they're saving money.
Yeah, I remember seeing a few years ago when I renewed my membership that at age 70, you could get some life membership either at very low cost or for free or something, and I don't see that anymore, so I think you're right, they're reconsidering the whole thing. And the other thing is, you mentioned finding it annoying to read on the bright screen. That is a problem for me, and I put both my computer and my iPhone in dark mode, and that helps a lot. So I have very low vision, and if you probably know, with low vision, bright light easily wipes out vision, so dark mode helps a whole lot, whatever it's worth. So if you haven't tried that, try that. I think you'll find a big difference.
Yeah, I've used dark mode. It's become increasingly popular. Microsoft is still kind of slow on the uptake. They really should have a feature that just kind of allows for global dark mode and require most of their programmers to insert it in their code and such, but that isn't how Microsoft works. They work on legacy. So little by little by little, their own application will be written or rewritten for dark mode. I have a lot of things set in dark mode, both on the computer and on my iPad. I still find that the technology that's used for Kindle, the paper display, is a little bit easier on the eyes because it's not emissive. It's purely reflexive. So it's a different technology, thankfully. I still like the feeling of turning pages and reading pieces of paper with ink on it. I guess I'm just getting old and cranky in my old age.
A lot of people seem to prefer that. Ultimately, things like Kindle books and audio books are not doing all that well. I love the Kindle books and audio books, that's me. Everybody prefers different things. And Windows 10 does have a dark mode setting. You go into settings, find it. I believe I did it in Windows 10, and not just in Chrome. And then some programs, I had to go into the programs themselves and do it. I'm looking at my LinkedIn screen here, and that's in dark mode. I have Chrome in dark mode. Anyway, I think there's if I remember correctly, I actually did find a dark mode setting in the settings in my Windows 10. I'm seeing a computer I got in 2014. Go ahead.
Yeah, but the problem is that they put a toggle in, but they haven't rewritten a lot of their own software. So if you're using the Notepad and you switch to dark mode, you get the same white sheet. It's because they haven't gotten around yet to tying it into the operating system. And a lot of third parties don't tie it into the operating system. They'll enable it themselves, and you have to go to their own separate setup window. Some do, some don't. And, you know, you got to look for it, you know. And, you know, I guess you can Google it to see if people are talking about it. So it's worth the effort itself. So, yeah, they haven't quite gotten their act together. They haven't quite gotten their act together as far as ultra-high-resolution screens. You know, when they went from the standard, sub 2K monitors, everything was peachy keen. And then they went to the high resolution, and a lot of the old software renders microscopically. And they said, we'll fix that we'll any day now. And I think that was about 6, 7, 8 years ago.
Yeah, I think I've seen that issue, and I thought it was just me because I use weird settings. And yeah, I have an old version of Microsoft Word on here. I have a Word 2013 on here, and that's the bright, bright white screen. When I'm in Brooklyn, I have a newer machine there, which I have a Word 365 on there, and that works in dot-up mode beautifully. So, yeah, I hear where you're coming from. You don't have the newest web-based apps. You don't get the dark mode, and I do find that annoying. Probably in the next couple of months, I'm just going to hold machine here, even though it still limps along pretty well. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, ultimately, it depends upon what you do on these things. I do way too much on these things. Yeah. I often tell people, if you're curious, you go to my QRZ page, and there's a screenshot of what my screen looks like during the old science talk segment of the technical net. So I have loads of things. I have an i9 chip. I went mildly crazy. Although it's about 6 years old, which is kind of middle-aged, I think, for a computer. I think once you get past about 10, 11 years, it's going to be rather cranky, but I still got a few more good years with this one. But it depends. I mean, I know people who just use it to read their email, and they do occasional web browsing of simple sites. And for them, they could keep a 15-year-old computer without any problems.
Yeah, well, this machine, yeah, I have a machine that's about 9 years old I'm looking at now, and most of the time it works fairly well. It seems occasionally to really get bogged down when it does updates or something, go over and not run for about a week, and then suddenly starts working reasonably well again. But, yeah, I think it is about the point where it replaces it. I just find it a pain to change the screens. I use a lot of custom settings to make sure I can see the screens, but I'm going to have to give in and do that pretty soon. Anyway, I have some other things to do here. I want to pop back on for the space net a bit later, so let you go on and see if anybody else has questions before you go on to Paul. You'll be too good, so.
Okay, very good, Frank. Thank you for participating, as always. And we'll talk to you down the line.
Talk later.
Okay, this is AC2GS, continues with the Limark Technical Net. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, please feel free. Hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign.
AC2VHD.
Yes, Jim.
Intriguing commentary there. I wanted to make a comment on something. It was interesting hearing about the Russian hams. I haven't done any intercontinental EX yet. I've gone as far as Maine and Florida, and about it. But the thought occurs to me that there's probably a lot more in common between us individual American ham operators and Russian ham operators than there is between Russian ham operators and their government. Parallel between individual ham operators here and our government. Interesting thought. It's not a theory. It's just a thought.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thought. I mean, people are people. There are commonalities. There are differences. You know, sometimes listening to 75 meters, some of the guys, what they have to say, strikes me as something that doesn't sound anything like any of my opinions. So, you know, sometimes you don't have to go that far to bump into someone whose mind works completely different than my own.
There is no doubt. I will bring up the ham radio explanation, but thought on that. Some people can set up a 160-meter antenna, and some people can set up a 2-meter antenna. They live different lives.
Yeah, I'll give you that. To an extent, there is general, and most people who listen long enough will agree that you'll have a much more, pound-for-pound technical discussion on the lower bands than you do on repeaters, because the number of people who put in a little bit more thought and expertise to operating reasonably well on the lower bands is greater than what's required for repeaters. You get yourself a store-bought radio and a store-bought antenna and put it a little bit higher than the ground, and you're in business. So there's a lot more people discussing, drugstores on the corner that closed 50 years ago versus the types of topics that tend to somewhat be brought up on 75 meters.
No doubt, it's a difference. Like you said, you can with $50, you could be all over the place on the higher frequencies. Anchors is the other thing. I'll bring your attention to something. I don't know if you've ever heard. There's a song written by a guy. I think it was Frank McCutcheon, if I'm not mistaken, and called "Christmas in the Trenches." It's written from the point of a World War II soldier. Last line of the song is, "On each end of the rifle, we're the same." And in that case, it was referring to American soldiers and German soldiers, I suppose. But it's an interesting, when that song came to mind when you were bringing up the Russian radio operators. And how people, as varied as we are, have many commonalities. And here we are. Back to Roy.
AC2GS. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that. I remember hearing stories during World War I that people were being slaughtered in the trenches, and it was just a row of Englishmen on one side and Germans on the other shooting at each other. And I think at one point around Christmas time, they somehow figured out a way to have their own private temporary armistice, and they stopped shooting at each other. Someone, of course, had a soccer ball. They kicked it around a bunch, and humanity kind of did a little glimmer show itself before the captains and colonels and such got wind of it and stopped it rather quickly. So, soldiers are just, unfortunately, soldiers for the most part. I don't imbue them with any kind of yes or no, black or white, yay or nay type of binary existence. They just take orders, unfortunately.
That song is about that very incident, and it's very moving. I don't know if I necessarily want to drink a lot of scotch with that guy, because I might not agree with much of what he says, but man, he knocks it out of the park with that one. And it's about that very story. It's a great piece of humanity.
Yeah, it's one of the few stories that gives me hope for humanity. If you live long enough, you hear enough terrible tragedies of people screwing around with other people for a little gain, just for the sake of screwing around with them. That's one of the great stories that demonstrates actual humanity, as far as I'm concerned. So yeah, I don't think I've ever heard the song. I got to look it up. But I've heard that story being told for decades upon decades. It's probably the best World War One story I have.
Oh, his iteration of the song knocks down the park, rips down, reaches down your throat, throws your heart out, and drops it in front of you, still beating it. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to do the political net, but, you know, World War One was such a terrible disaster. It was a completely, ultimately meaningless war. It was just our guys against your guys, a bunch of colonial wing nuts who basically threw their citizens into the firing squad. The flower of French youth, of German youth, and of English youth, and of Russian youth were slaughtered in that completely meaningless thing.
Agreed. I'd love to go down this path, but I don't think that's where you want to go. Can I pull it back to some technology-related topic?
Certainly.
I baited you for that a little bit. It wasn't totally unintentional, but I apologize, sir. I'm curious, in the Israeli border incursion recently occurred, occurs to me that shouldn't radar have kind of been involved with something of what happened, and apparently not, and we have some experts in that field, and I was wondering if they had any ideas on what happened there, and if it has any repercussions for us here on the eastern border, northeastern maritime border of our country. Keep it technical. Back to you, Roy.
Well, I will throw it out to the audience. The audience has been kind of quiet tonight. I think our usual technical experts, many of them have other things to do tonight than listen and participate, but I'll throw it out. I think it was unfortunately partially hubris. I think the Israelis kind of believed their own public relations, which is always kind of dangerous to do, even if it is legitimate, but, you know, there's only so much that it's legitimate. And also, unfortunately, they got tricked the same damn way that they got tricked 50 years ago. It was during a holiday, so they had sent a lot of their personnel home for the holidays. This is exactly what they did on the Yom Kippur War. So you'd think they'd learn, but I guess 50 years, people forget. Anyway, if anyone out there has any expertise in radar and has any insight into the situation of how did it take the Israeli armed defense forces that long to figure out something was going wrong out there, please chime in. Well, as I thought, just crickets.
I had hoped that there would be some technical expertise to throw in on this, because I do not have it. I'll fall back to the line in that song I mentioned just previous to the last line, and you can look it up. It's worthy of listening to. But I'll throw it up there again. Any insight into this thing as far as radar and like systems? Is it something we should be thinking about or knowing? Either at the voting booth or in our town about this?
Again, I really don't think so. I mean, if you look into the what went on, a lot of it doesn't sound like it's for real. I still remember watching people looking at the news report.
I think you dropped out, Roy. Is that correct?
I didn't get... okay, I'm back on again. I think the problem is that a lot of it went below the radar to begin with. You had the paragliders. I don't know if that shows up on any kind of radar that military use. Then they blasted through the walls. That certainly isn't going to show up on any radar. So I think they went underneath the radar. I think that's as far as I understand it. So I don't think you have to particularly worry that radar technology is fallible. It's just that these guys live next door, so it's a different situation than anyone who's going to attack from abroad here in the United States. I guess theoretically they could pull something like that on the Mexican or Canadian border, but even that, I think there's a lot of space between population centers that doesn't exist between Gaza and the farms that are set up right next door to the enclosures.
Not knowing much about what goes on over there, I admit, the commonality that strikes me is I got a whole lot of dead friends that were surprised in New York a few years ago. And coming from a different technique that was metaphorically off the radar, maybe we've got to expand our radar some. So it's a technological question, but it's also a thought question. So those of us that play in these forums of information exchange, yet rarely exchange information other than the weather, I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with the question. I just wanted to throw out the idea for consideration.
Okay, I understand, Jim. I mean, ultimately, the solution probably is something close to eternal vigilance. That's not the way human beings work. We get fatigued. We get tired of subjects. We like to move on to other things. We're easily distracted. We're looking for a good time. So when it's a holiday, you like to celebrate the holiday. So they just got caught a second time. Rich, W2BZ, also, I think, wanted to make comments. So, Rich, what would you like to add to this?
Now, I'd like to add that it was a combination of a lot of different factors. The Israeli government was much more concerned with terrorist activities on the West Bank than they were either on the northern border or Gaza. That's number one. Number two is, as Boy mentioned, it was a holiday, just like it was a holiday 50 years ago in one day when the Yom Kippur War broke out. And the other thing was that Israel's been going through a real social upheaval with Netanyahu's judicial reform initiative, where they would give the power to the prime minister for oversight of the judiciary. And that was bringing out half of the country in revolt. So that was going on, too. So Gaza took the back seat to all of this, and they got caught. Took the back seat to all of this at the very worst time it could have. I don't know how the Hamas kept it so secretive, because they have brothers and sisters and parents, and so if there were 1,000 members of Hamas that murdered all these civilians, these Israeli civilians, probably about 4 or 5 times that knew about it and still kept it quiet. But I guarantee you that all ears are on Hamas now, technologically speaking. There's not a cell phone conversation that's not being recorded now, so, but now's a little late. Anyway, that's my opinion, or gathering of facts, Roy. Back to you.
AC2GS. Well, thank you, Rich. I heard some relatively intelligent comment from retired U.S. general types that suggested that very likely most of the troops were given very little information until right before the assault. They kept it on a kind of need-to-know basis. Because, if they told everyone, then, the entire place would light up. So they had to be somewhat clever in keeping the important information sequestered among a much smaller number of people. And, they do apparently a lot of things under tunnels and such, too. So it's not that easy to kind of see through the ground to the tunnels. So, it's a mess. I don't see any solution that doesn't lead to a lot of innocent murder that's going to go on. But humanity, once again, most of the time, terrible stories to be said about human beings.
And it turned out to be B2BX, so with a comma.
Only Frank.
Yeah, presumably Israelis and probably the American NSA also did have cell phone intercepts of the Hamas rehearsals with the paragliders, and Hamas kind of would have conversations on their deceptive conversations on their cell phones, supposedly knowing they were being intercepted, saying, you know, we're never really going to do this. This is just practice. We're being deterred from doing anything. Yeah, I haven't heard recordings of the, or translated recordings of the actual conversation, but it sounds like these people were almost sarcastic, and probably the translators didn't pick up, humor and sarcasm doesn't translate, as I understand it, very well between languages. So I would suspect that the translators, although very experienced, just did not pick up on the sarcasm in the translations and realize that, you know, these people aren't kidding. This is something they might actually try. It's not just hypothetical. They're not just doing this to fun. I think your World War I analogy is very good. It's the war that seems to be shaping up. Going to be very long, get a lot of people killed, and like World War I be very, very pointless and not really resolve anything. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the Israeli government is priming people for a 10-year war. I don't know how any government is going to sustain that. Public opinion is just going to wreck them from the outside in. But maybe their weird idea is it's really only going to take them 9 months. So if they say 10 years and it goes to a year and a half, they all end up deserving a gold star or something. I don't know. There's no easy solution. I don't think of myself that I could come up with, you know, peace in the Middle East like good old Jared Kushner could. But I don't know what the answer is. I don't think this is the answer, whatever this is going to turn into.
Well, the other thing is that Israel has not been in the practice of looking for 1,000 terrorists that primarily were sent to kill civilians. They've been used to, in the 73 war, there were 30,000 troops converging on Israel on October 6, 1973. 30,000, not 1,000. But there was soldier against soldier. It wasn't terrorists against civilians. So they didn't see a massive buildup like they had in the past when armies were being, you know, massed on the Suez Canal, for instance. They weren't looking at, you know, the minutia of 1,000 terrorists. So that was also a problem. Listen, it's going to take another 50. Just a movie came out that I saw called Golda about the surprise of the 73 war, and it's going to take another 50 years for another movie to come out about this, too. It's going to be Investigative Nightmare or Treasure Trove of how this could have happened. It's going to take a long time to get the answer.
PhD. Yes, Jim?
So I started this trying to keep it technical, and I didn't mean to go off that track. It has, and I'm okay with that, but I'm also okay if we get back on track. And I'll throw this at you. Does anybody think that these folks that flew over the border like monkeys from Wizard of Oz thought they were going to, like, take out Israel? But the goal certainly wasn't to, like, take out Israel. That was the furthest thing from any remote possibility. So what was their goal? Just to piss people off? Something doesn't fit this whole thing. It stinks.
I'm sure there's a few people with a few opinions, and I'll let them speak. I think they were expecting pretty much what's been happening and what's going to continue happening. Things were quieting down. Saudi Arabia was starting to talk to Israel. Iran thought that they were going to lose a bunch of useful operatives in their never-ending battle of becoming the great Persian Empire someday, and set Hamas to punch the guy in the nose and leave him with a bleeding nose and run away and wait for him and his pals to come looking for them and beat the crap out of everyone. So I think they were trying. I mean, that's sort of what terrorists tend to do. They promote terror and chaos and death on both sides, and then use public relations schemes to point the finger at the opposing enemy. And I think they're getting exactly what they wanted. You know, I don't know what else they could do to piss people off. You know, kidnap children and old ladies and threaten to kill them. I mean, you know, you just kind of like, I don't see any other purpose than just to wreak havoc and terror and drive the entire Middle East into World War III.
So did they, you know, who knows how many paragliders there were, maybe, you know, 50, 20, something like that? No, they didn't think they were going to beat the state of Israel. They were sent to kill as many children and women as they could find. And as Roy said, just to cause terror. And without thinking of their own people getting killed because of their actions, they couldn't care less about how many of their own people were going to get killed and still are going to be killed because of their actions. They couldn't care less. Wasn't a thought in their mind about how many of their own people are going to suffer because of their actions. They just wanted to kill as many children and women and men, thirdly, as they could get headlines written about them around the world.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Rich. Jim, I don't think that you can look at this as a strategy. This is not a army. This is a terrorist group. And you know, why in the good old days did the IRA blow stuff up? You know, was there a strategic reason for that other than to piss people off and to terrorize other people? I think this is a different mindset than, you know, armies and other defensive, you know, fighting organizations.
Perhaps. I know this was an avenue that you probably didn't want to go down, and I don't want to drag you down any further. You can move on.
Okay, very good, Jim. We have a little time left. It's up to you guys. If you are so inclined, if you have any questions or comments, please hit that push-to-talk button and give us your name and your call sign.
This is WB2IKT, Whiskey Baker 2, Tango, and George. I have a question.
George, what's your question?
Okay, simply put, I have a DMR radio that has a code block, and I'm having my fair share of issues with it, but really not the question. My question is, I've been through the MetroCore website, and they have a list of stations that have been officially coordinated. I have ARRL guide repeaters, and I have a New York repeater directory. And what I'm looking for is someone maintaining a list of what actual and real repeaters that one can key up in the area, and that's relatively close and being up to date. Where can I find such a thing if I can't? So that's really my question. Up to date, current information on the state of publicly available repeaters on the 2-meter, 220 band, and on the 440 band? That's the question, sir.
Okay, George, might I ask, where are you located approximately?
Okay, QTH here is Hicksville, New York, kind of in the middle of Nassau County. I have a mobile rig.